give you my name tag because more than likely I'll forget to leave it in the back for Johnny Paul. Hi, everybody. I am truly a grateful alcoholic, and my name is Choicy.
Hey, Choicy.
And it's good to be here this morning. And Terry was getting tearful a little earlier, and I know how she feels. You know, I've worked on conferences and the assembly and several things down through the years, you know. And I've reached several mountaintops in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And most of those mountaintops have been reached through service, you know, doing something like she has done this weekend. And let me tell you, if you've never been involved in putting on a roundup like this, it's just like you're meeting at your home group if you're a newcomer. It doesn't just happen. It requires, you know, people to suit up and show up. And as Tim talked earlier this weekend about being responsible, you know, there's work that goes on behind the scenes to make a deal like this happen. You know, and my payoff, you know, in my mountaintop was always seeing people enjoying themselves, seeing people having a good time, and seeing people know what sobriety in this fellowship is all about. And I know that's how Terry feels this morning. And so let's give the committee a big hand again. You know, I am sure grateful that Johnny Paul turned this mic on because you know, there was a time before I got here that I didn't need a microphone, you know, back in my drinking days. And, you know, you could have heard me all the way probably to St. Simon's at times without a mic. But since I've gotten sober, that's not the way it is at times, you know, I'll have times to lose my voice. I just smoked too long, you know, and yelled too much and drank too much. But this is really a treat for Jimmy and I to be invited down to the Serenity Weekend. And before I get started, before I forget, I want to, if any of you didn't meet my better half, my partner, and the best man I know, Jimmy, wave at him. And I am truly grateful that he is here. You know, he's heard my story over and over and over, and from one end of this state to the other end, and he keeps suiting up and showing up with me, and I'm grateful for that. But this is a special weekend. My sobriety date is March 19th, 1985, and my first AA conference roundup was a Serenity Weekend here at Jekyll. In 1985, and I am so grateful for that. There was a couple that a few of you back then might have known Fred M. He had been a DCM for District 13J in Metro, and him and Pat was in Al-Anon, and Fred was in AA, and they took Jimmy and I under their wings, and they had another AA Al-Anon couple down in Swainsboro, Ray and Liddell Kennedy, and Ray's gone now, and Fred's gone to the meeting in the sky now, and we all got in the car, and we came down here to Jekyll, you know, and you talk about the high that I felt that weekend, And that's how our road started. And for many years, Jimmy and I were able to come back down to Serenity Weekend. And then it seems like, you know, sobriety's been good to me, and my life keeps getting busier. It did. And so there was a few years we weren't able to come back because of other commitments. But this is where it all got started for me. You know, down at the Buccaneer, and I bet they'd have on Saturday night 600 to 1,000 people in that room. It'd be packed, you know. And some of the old-timers, Mr. Joe P., Joe Parker, you know, from the middle of Georgia area. You know, at the time I met him, I think he had 30-something years, and he died about 10 years ago, or a little over 10 years ago. And I think about all the faces and all the people I met that roundup and the years coming back. And as a result of that, I can tell you that I had no idea how much joy was going to be my journey, you know, as a result of finding Alcoholics Anonymous in this fellowship. And so it is really a special treat to be invited to the Serenity Weekend to share with you. And I was hoping, I've already thanked Jerry in case I had one of my senior moments, and I can have legitimate senior moments. So I've already thanked him for taping, and but you know, Johnny Powell's done a great job this weekend, and it's always a pleasure to be with Johnny and to hear him share, and he is just so quick on his feet, you know, and I wish I had that gift, and I had received more gifts this weekend from all of our speakers that have shared, and so I want to say thank you to all of you. You know, Joni, I was really hoping that when the committee asked me, I'd be the Thursday night speaker, you know. And, you know, so I could get my deal over with and just sit back and relax. And then when I talked with Terry and Lisa and found out that I was going to be the Sunday morning speaker, and I thought, I'm not that spiritual, you know. And I got to sit and think about this deal the whole weekend, you know. And but I want to thank the committee again and all the Lisas. There's several Lisas on that committee and Terry for inviting me down. And I guess there's a reason that I am supposed to be the Sunday morning speaker. And I've suited up and showed up, and I'm waiting for God to show up. But I did hope that I would be the Thursday night speaker, but Joni kicked us off in style, you know, and she talked about that insanity that we all experienced, or the insanity I experienced, you know, and I truly, for many years, didn't know what the true nature of the problem was. You know, I thought the insanity in my life was caused by everything and everybody else, you know, not by me and my drinking. And I am truly grateful that I eventually found out what the true nature of the problem was. You know, and then Friday afternoon, Tim shared, you know, and he had a beautiful message. And he talked about learning in this fellowship what our maximum purpose is, to be of service to God and the people about us. You know, and I am so grateful that has come to be part of my life today and my true purpose. You know, and I could identify with so much of your story, and you talking about, you know, taking care of your mother, you know, and there was a time in my life that I would, you know, my folks divorced in 1970, and so I had a role reversal. You know, I became the parent. And not long ago, last year, my mother had a wreck, and she called me, and she had just had one a few weeks before then. And she said, can you come and get me? And I said, sure. And I said, you're not going to be there by yourself, are you? And she said, no, the police will be here with me. They're going to wait until you can get here. And so, you know, I hopped in the car and I went over to Camp Creek Parkway and I did the U-turn and pulled in and parked and I got out and I walked up to the policeman and I said, hi, I'm Joyce Wren. I'm her mother. Y'all, that wasn't planned. That just instantly came out, you know. And she calls me her mother. She introduced me. This is Mama, you know. And so believe me, I had the role reversal and still am doing that role reversal. You know, but they had divorced, and so I've been the caregivers, the giver through the years. And my daddy died in 1989 of cancer. And before we dealt with that, I had times before I got sober, you know, that he would be going through surgery and I'd be at the hospital and I'd be taking care of him and staying all night. And what I would do in order to do that is I would go into the bathroom in his room and I'd take my pocketbook and I'd pull my bottle out and I'd take a drink. And I am so grateful that sobriety gave me an opportunity to take care of him sober. You know. And then Jane shared Saturday night, or Friday night. And Jane, that was a message of hope. It was a message that I heard of hope. And that's what I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't do time behind bars. I should have. But I definitely did time in my mind, between my ears. You know, and perhaps there's lots of others here that did that. You know, I was a salesman by trade, And back in the 70s, there weren't many women on the road. And I worked for a manufacturer of ladies and children's sportswear. And all the salesmen, the territorial salesman, was making the money. And I was in in-house sales, you know. And so I fought to be given that same opportunity. You know, and so, you know, Jim talked about that sense of failure Saturday night, you know, and it was like the pressure I put on myself, you know, and that ego, you know, I've got to succeed at this, you know, or I'll block the way for all the women behind me, you know. But for many years, I would catch a plane Monday morning from Hartsville, and I'd fly to Oklahoma or Ohio or New York or Texas, wherever I could write business. And then I'd come home Thursday night or Friday morning. And I started doing that when my little girl was 6 weeks old, back doing it when she was 6 weeks old. And sometimes I'd go into the office on Fridays, and sometimes I wouldn't. And I can remember when she was about 2.5 years old, it was in December, and it was a Friday afternoon, and it was the last work day before Christmas. Christmas either fell on Sunday or Monday of that year. And so me and the owner of the company and a couple other people, we went down to the Holiday Inn for lunch. And, of course, we had our drinks at lunch. And see, my job was a great enabler, because when I was on the road, you know, those buyers sitting on the other table, they love to be wined and dined. And so we went down to the Holiday Inn, and we drank our lunch instead of ate it, and stayed there all afternoon. And then I headed to Douglasville to pick up my little girl from the nursery. And a car pulled out in front of me, and I went off the road to avoid that car, and I chopped 4 pine trees down. And that night when I got home from the hospital, thank God my daughter only had a scratch on her thumb, you know, and I hit the windshield, but you know, had some cuts and bruises, but not as bad as it could have been. And I found a phone number and a name of a man in my pocketbook, and I picked up the telephone and I called this man. The reason I had called him is I wanted to thank him, because I thought that perhaps he was one of them that stayed there until the police and the ambulance could get there and help with my little daughter and helped us. And so I called to thank him. And what I found out was that on my way home to Douglasville that afternoon, when I left work or left that Holiday Inn, traffic had stopped on I-20. And I'd hit him in the back. And I had been in a blackout. So, but by the grace of God, there go I, you know. And I can remember coming home when she was about 5 years old. And she was in kindergarten. And that Friday morning, I had gotten home Thursday night. And that Friday morning, I didn't go to the office. And I called the office to see if I had any messages. And I left the house about 11:30 to go and pick her up. You know, well, I didn't make it. You know, I ended up losing control of the car, and I had a glass of scotch with me. You know, and I didn't look real good. I had my hair in a ponytail. You know, I was barefooted and had a T-shirt and shorts on. And I nosed into a ditch head on. And so I got out. Luckily, I was okay, but I slung that glass of scotch across the woods, you know, and I went walking down the road to use somebody's phone to call a wrecker. And who did I meet? State Patrol. Well, next thing I knew, I was in the back of that State Patrol car because he smelled alcohol, and I got taken to the police station there in Douglasville. The only reason they didn't lock me up, Jane, was because they knew my husband's family, you know? And sometimes I have thought that had they locked me up, had I been sentenced to AA meetings, would my drinking have stopped then, you know? But I am so grateful that my daughter was not in the car. So, but by the grace of God, there go I. And then Bo shared, and he talked about the family disease Saturday morning, you know. And folks, when I got here in March of 1985, I absolutely knew nothing of alcoholism, of the disease of alcoholism. And I didn't know that my entire family was sick. You know, I had been born in a totally typical, normal Southern Baptist alcoholic home. And I didn't know we were alcoholic growing up. And you know, I can remember my mother fussing because of my daddy's drinking. And I used to think, well, if Daddy didn't drink, Mother wasn't fussed. If Mother didn't fuss, Daddy wasn't drinking. I didn't know which one came first, you know. But, you know, I never saw my daddy really drink except just a couple of times because my grandfather was a Baptist minister, and so they just really did not drink socially in the home, you know. And we'd go on vacation. Sometimes I'd know they was drinking. I didn't know there was a time in my life where my daddy probably had his own bootlegger working for him. But there was a time in his life that before he got up in the morning time, he took a drink. He put his pants on, he took a drink. Before he made coffee, he took a drink. And he was a maintenance drinker for many years, and until right before I got sober, when I was 36 years old, was the first time I ever saw my daddy drink. And you see, I drank like my daddy did. And thank God for the chapter in the big book. Then he talks about the different alcoholics. You know, the first time I had a drink, I didn't get drunk, get sick, and black out. You know, I drank several years, and Jimmy and I even drank for several years. And we had some good times together before the booze took over. But once I crossed that line, all hell broke loose in my home. And the things that happened when I was a child, you know, started happening in my own home. But we see, we knew nothing growing up about the family disease of alcoholism, and our entire family was sick. And thank God, you know, we've got a program for recovery for both. And through my years of being in the program and early on, and grateful for the times I was able to go on 12-step calls, at times I've seen family members, I believe, become sicker than the person afflicted physically with the disease. You know, and after I got sober, I fought the disease concept for a long time. I thought it was a whole bunch of drunks that wrote this book right here, just to rid themselves of guilt, you know. And so I was one that had to read everything I could get my hands on about the physical disease of alcoholism, for me to come to believe that I truly had a physical illness. And I know today there's a difference between me and my husband. You know, when he drank enough to feel it, it told him a total different message than it told me. It told him he was out of control and he was not okay, and so he stopped drinking. When I eventually drank enough to feel it, it told me I was okay, I was at ease, and I could do the things I needed to do. You know, and I drank for 18 years. And out of those 18 years, 9 years, it was probably the best friend I ever found. You know, it was the only thing that told me I was okay. And then when it stopped working, I never knew it would not work again. And I had those days of sitting at my table in my dining room with that bottle in front of me saying, the next one I'm going to get it. The next one I'm going to get it. And never knowing I'd never get it again. And there's no doubt in my mind today that I would never get it again. And I know that this is a family disease because my entire family got sick. You know, you don't do things like we did without being sick. Jimmy and I were sharing with June and Jane before the meeting, and Jimmy said, you know, Joycey has said that, he said, I know I was sick. He said, she's told me that she wouldn't have put up with the stuff out of me that she did for 6 months. And he put up with it a lot longer than I did, you know. And, you know, we used to hide the bottles from each other. He'd hide it so I wouldn't drink. I'd hide it so he wouldn't find my stash and wouldn't pour it out. And believe me, whenever he watered it down, I knew it, you know. I mean, I could just tell it. And we lived on a lake, and if he didn't try to drink it up, he'd pour it in the lake, you know. And we did all those games, you know. And we really, until the booze took over, we didn't yell and scream at each other. And then when it took over, all those, that insecurity and that low self-esteem and those resentments would just come out. And I would call him things that I would never call him sober, you know. And the fighting and the fussing started in our homes. And there would be times we would be standing up and I'd be in his face and all of a sudden the doorbell would ring. And it would be my in-laws. And my little girl, 2 years old, 3 years old, 4 years old, would pick up the telephone and she'd call her grandparents and she'd say, Mama and Daddy's fighting and fussing and I'm scared. Can you come and get me? And we'd stop doing what we were doing and we could see the pain and, you know, and the hurt in their eyes. And they tell us that Stephanie had called them. And we'd stop and we'd give her to them, and they would leave. And we'd close that door, and we'd pick up and go back at each other as if we'd never missed a beat. And that happened more times than one time, more times than I'd like to think about it. You know, sane people just don't do those things. Sick people do those things. And that's why our lives had gotten before I found Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and then Jim talked Saturday night. You know, he talked about that. You know, I too, Harry, picked up on the guilt. And I can remember, you know, I told you I fought to, and I really did. It was hard for me to accept that I had a physical disease. I thought I had failed, you know. And, you know, 2 weeks before I found this fellowship, I stood up in the First Baptist Church in Douglasville, and I did the devotional on how Paul tells us in Philippians we can have the peace of God, we can have the comfort of God, and we can rid ourselves of this anxiety. And I was having an anxiety attack when I was doing it. And I probably had a drink when I got home, you know. And I was wanting what I was sharing, but I just could not get it. And I can remember being 3 months sober and driving back into my subdivision. I had dropped my daughter off at school, and she was in the second grade. And I can remember this as if it was yesterday. As long as I live, I'm going to have it thrown up to me that I'm an alcoholic. But I didn't see it quite as nice as that, you know. Well, Jimmy didn't get up that morning and say, "Hi, wife. Hi, alcoholic. How are you doing today?" It was 8:30 in the morning. I hadn't been to an 11 o'clock meeting yet, you know. But I had that guilt and that remorse and that shame, you know. And folks, if I had not found a way to get rid of that, I probably wouldn't be sober today. Because I came in here with so much garbage inside of me. And I looked at life as if I was looking at it from the bottom of a trash can. You know, and if I didn't have a way to get rid of that, I don't know where I'd be today. But thank God you people helped me to clean that garbage out from inside and get rid of that guilt. You know, and also Jim, Jimmy's a Vietnam veteran, and on his car at home he has a Vietnam vet tag. You know, and Jimmy and I were 19 when we got married, and we weren't even old enough to buy booze. And he got drafted 4 months after we got married. And we also tried to get a hole for him to stay in the States. I was pregnant with our first child, or got pregnant before he got sent overseas, and we tried to get a hole for him to stay in the States until little Jim was born, but we couldn't. And so he shipped over, and it was around 10 of 1969. And while I was over there, our first child was born. And this was back in the days before they did the sonograms and told you if it was a little boy or a little girl. And we just knew it was going to be a little boy, and we'd named it Little Jim, and he'd write home, "I guess Little Jim's here by now," you know. And unfortunately, we didn't know anything was wrong until I was in labor. And so they sent word and shipped him home on emergency leave. And he didn't have to go back, thank God. But our baby didn't make it. He only lived 9 hours. You know, and as a result of that, we were able to get a compassionate reassignment, and Jimmy finished out his tour in the States, and I'm grateful for that. And the reason I share this with you is there's lots of things that have played a big part in my recovery in the last 23 years since I've been here. You know, I introduced myself this morning as a grateful alcoholic, and I am. And I don't say that for y'all. I say that for me. What that does and what that tells me is that who I am and what I am and where I came from and where I'm at today. And I have never 12-stepped anybody that had a grateful heart that morning, you know. And so if I can walk through my day with a grateful heart, I got a chance to stay sober today. And I'll keep that conscious contact with a loving God. You know, but, you know, I told you I was raised in that typical, normal Southern Baptist alcoholic home. But I didn't know how to let God work in my life. And when my when little Jim died, and that guilt, you know, it was like I must have done something or Jimmy must have done something. We were being punished, you know, for some reason for God to take our child. And I couldn't accept that situation. And I went down with my height to about 79 pounds, and that's kind of like walking death, you know. And I couldn't let go of it, and I got sick physically and emotionally and spiritually. And I know today that when I am not accepting a situation or a person just exactly as it is, I'm going to get sick physically, emotionally, and spiritually. And so that's when I look back on that experience, you know, that's what I see out of that. You know, and after about 2 years, I was finally able to accept that. And the way I was able to accept it was, you know, I guess God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. But I got to thinking one day is that, you know, I knew that little Jim was innocent and in heaven. And I do believe in heaven. And but if Jimmy had not come back home, I didn't know that about him. And if it had to happen as it did, maybe God used that situation or that to bring him home. And I was able to finally accept it and let it go. And I started getting better physically and emotionally. Don't know that I really got better spiritually, you know. Except it wasn't long after that I found out what booze could do for me. You know, and so I've shared a little bit with you about how I was in my drinking. You know, I gave up that job that when I used to, you know, Tim, I asked him where Brooklyn, is that it? Brookmont, Ohio was, and he said outside of Cleveland. I used to fly into Cleveland. I had accounts in Canton, Akron. And I didn't know anything about Dr. Bob or Alcoholics Anonymous at that time, you know. And I can remember being at the Holiday Inn calling on a customer outside of Cleveland, and snow was on the ground. And I had taken her out, the buyer, out to eat that night, and we did some drinking, you know, and I went back to the hotel, and I was supposed to drive into Cleveland the next morning and catch an airplane. And then I was flying on to Detroit to call on Kay Martin in Troy, Michigan. And I smoked at that time, and my room door had been making sticking and stuff like that. And I got in that night, and I went in, and I got in my hotel room, and I realized I was out of cigarettes. So I was going to run downstairs and get a pack of cigarettes. Well, when I tried to get out of the room, I couldn't get out. The door wasn't open. And here's about 2 feet of snow, it seemed like, on the outside. So I called down to the front desk, and it's about 2 in the morning, and I wasn't feeling any pain. And I told the guy on the desk, I said, my door is stuck, and I can't get out of my room, and I've got a flight the next morning. And I said, I'm going to have to be leaving the hotel early in the morning. And I said, can you send somebody up to unlock my door or unstick it? And he said, yes, ma'am. I said, well, on your way up, can you bring me a pack of cigarettes? I'm out. You know, well, I don't know what he thought, you know, if I was going to get him up there and accuse him of rape or what, you know. But I looked through the little peephole, and I could see him, and I could see the security guard with him, you know. And they tried to get the door open. They couldn't get the door open. So he goes back downstairs, and he calls me. He said, ma'am, we're going to have to call maintenance people in. And I said, well, I hate for y'all to do that. And he said, well, we can't have you locked in the room in case of fire. Well, about 4 o'clock that morning, here comes the maintenance people trucking with a little ladder. You know, I looked out my window, and they called, and they said, pull the tape off the windows and open up the windows. And I was on the second floor, and they crawled through the window of the hotel room, you know, and then took the hinges off the door. And that's is one of the experiences that I had in Canton, Akron, Ohio. And, you know, and I think about, you know, Jimmy used to get the calls from New York or wherever I was, and I'd, after I'd get in to that hotel room, and I'd be drunk, and I'd say, look what I'm having to do, look what you're doing to us, you know, and I had that guilt and that remorse of leaving him and leaving my little girl at home. And then eventually what I thought, you know, is what I need to do is I need to stay at home, and I need to be the mother that I hadn't been allowed to be, and then I'll be okay. And so I did. I gave up that job, and I gave up that title, and I gave up that paycheck, you know. So I've had those things, and I still had that hole inside of me. And I thought I wouldn't drink as much. And what I found out is I just had more time to drink, you know. Jimmy would, it was all right for me to take a drink on the airplane at 6:30 or 8:30 in the morning time if I was, you know, flying somewhere when that no smoking sign went off, and I'd get a couple of belts under my drinks inside me, and I knew I could do what I needed to do the days ahead of me. You know, but I never thought that before he would be pulled out of our driveway at 8:30 in the morning time, I would have the refrigerator open and I would be filling up an iced tea glass full of ice and filling it full of scotch or bourbon, whatever I had there to drink. And that's what started happening after I quit work. And I had those days, I'd sit at that dining room table and I'd say, I'm only going to drink until 2 o'clock today. And then when Jimmy gets home, I'll be sober and we won't fight and fuss tonight. And I might do that today. I might drink a whole quart and a couple six packs on top of it. You know, and he'd come home, and I had quit at 2 o'clock that afternoon, and I'd fix dinner, and we wouldn't fight and fuss that night. Next day, I'd get up, same intentions, only going to drink till 2 o'clock. He gets home, I'll be sober, and we won't fight and fuss. Next thing I'd know is that I'd be coming out of a blackout at 6:30 or 8:30 at night, and I'd be standing in his face calling him some god-awful names that I would never call him sober. And I'd say, what happened to 2 o'clock? You see, what had happened with me is I had lost all predictability once I picked up that drink, that first drink. I never knew if I was going to be able to drink all day, or I never knew if I was going to immediately go into a blackout. And then March of 1985 came, and things were really bad in our life. You know, and before I quit that job, if things got bad at home, I'd just break out in a spot. I'd start a trip early instead of Monday morning. I might head to the airport Saturday night. You know, or either I'd get in my car and I'd point it east or west on I-20. I drove to Laurel, Mississippi one night with a Bible beside me. I'd pull into a service station. I'd call home at 7 or 7:30 the next morning and see if they're okay. And I'd get in the car and I'd drive right back home, you know, hoping that one of these days he was going to find out what was wrong with me and he was going to fix it, you know. But I had given up that job, and my car evidently was in the shop. My father-in-law's owns a collision shop, a body shop. And he's put several cars together for me as a result of drinking and driving, you know. And so it must have been in the shop. And Jimmy wouldn't give me his keys. And we got into it, and so I called, picked up the phone, and I called a cab, and a cab picked me up. And I headed to the airport. And I got there, and I couldn't decide what plane to catch, and so I looked off in the distance, and I saw the Marriott, and I got in another cab and headed to the Marriott, and I had a Bible with me. And I sat in that hotel room that night, and I did a lot of drinking, and I had that soul sickness. And Tim, I had that aloneness that few of us come to know. You know, I was at a point of where I didn't want to go on living the way I had been living, but I didn't know any other way to go on. You know, and I didn't want to keep on drinking, but I had to drink in order to live. You know, and I had that aloneness and that ache in my heart. And I couldn't get drunk and I couldn't get sober. The next morning I called Jimmy and I told him where I was, and he knew the way I left. I didn't have much cash in my pocket. But his attitude was, you got yourself there, you get yourself home, you know. And I scraped up enough money to call another cab, and I got back to Douglasville. You know, and what we would always do the morning after, or after, you know, one of my breaking out in spots or whatever, we would walk around kind of like on eggshells, you know. And normally we'd get up in the morning time and he'd fix himself a cup of coffee, you know, and I'd send Stephanie off to school, and then he'd get his coffee and he'd leave. And he did something different that morning. He sat down across from the dining room table with me. And he said, Joycey, I know that nothing I say and nothing I do is going to make a difference with you. But somehow, he said, I've got to do something different for me and Stephanie. And with that, he got his coffee and he left. talk about that aloneness and that ache in your heart that I already had. It got deeper that morning. The last person that I ever thought would give up on me had given up. That's what I had heard. What I heard him say, and one of our speakers talked about, you know, you're going to hear whatever you're going to hear. You know, what I heard him say that morning was, if you're going to go on living the way you're living, so be it. But we're going to do something different. You know, thank God, folks, that man did that. That was the first best thing he ever did for me. Because what he did that day is he put the ball in my court. You know, the ball in my court. And I believe that had he not done that, and had he been willing to continue to do what he had been doing, I would probably try to drink longer. You know, I have learned in my recovery that unless there is reason for change, we don't change. Or at least this alcoholic does. I had been the caregiver of my step-grandmother, and I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't know anything about the disease of alcoholism. And I called the only psychiatrist I knew. I didn't know about treatment and why in the mid-80s was a heyday of treatment. And so I called the psychiatrist at Georgia Baptist Hospital. His name was Dr. Grumet. And I told him, I said, Dr. Grumet, if I'm not having a nervous breakdown, you know, I'm probably as close to it as you can get. And I might have a drinking problem, or at least my husband thinks I have a drinking problem. And and folks, that was probably the first best thing I ever did for me was making that phone call. You know, and I called Jimmy, Dr. Grumet said, look, Joycey, he said, be over here in the morning, and I'll have you already pre-admitted, and we'll see what we can do. And I said, okay. And I called Jimmy at work and told him what I had done, and he was absolutely tickled pink. And I made that call on March 18th, 1985. And that night he came home, and I can remember him sitting on the sofa in the bedroom, and I'm packing, and I'm crying, and I'm drinking. And that was the first time in a long, long time that man didn't fuss about my drinking. And I asked him later on, I said, why didn't you say something about me drinking that night? And he said, for some reason, I just thought that was going to be it. And that's when I had my last drink. You know, so I used March 19th as my sobriety date. The next morning we got up and we headed to Georgia Baptist, and I wasn't drinking, and I thought, God, what have I done to myself? You know? And we got over there, and they didn't have me pre-admitted. And I don't know if anybody has an ego like I do. You know, how dare you not already have a room waiting for me? You know? And they eventually got me a room, and I got in the room, and I found out later on why they didn't have a room. You see, I had been in and out of blackouts all the day before. The last time I remember talking to the doctor was him telling me that he would have me pre-admitted and have a room waiting for me the next morning and for me to come over. The last time I actually talked to him was in a blackout, and I told him I wasn't coming. And thank God I had been in a blackout, and I didn't remember that call, you know. So God did for me what I needed done. You know, and I was wanting help, and I was wanting to live different. I didn't like, you know, the person I had become. I didn't like the things that were happening in my home. And so I suited up, and I showed up on that psych floor, and they didn't have AA meetings at Georgia Baptist at that time. And the other patient, I was the only patient on that floor. That it was a lockdown psych ward. My step-grandmother had an illness similar to schizophrenia, and I used to have to put her there. And so I was the only one that talked about my drinking, you know. There was one girl that talked about her husband's drinking. You know, and so I suited up and I showed up. And Tim mentioned the MMPI test. I had those. And I had been there, I guess, about a week and a half, and I sat in my hospital room, and the psychiatrist came in, and I said, okay, I've had the ink blot test, MMPI, and I said, group, I've sat with you, what do you think? And he looked at me with a degree of humility that I'd not seen in anybody else before. He was a paid professional, and I was there for help, and I truly did not know what was wrong. And he said, Joycey, he said, with the people that I have worked with in the past, with the makeup like yours, there's nothing I can do. And I said, what? And he said, there is nothing I can do. And I said, there's got to be something that you or I can do. And he said, Joycey, all I know is that unless you find a new way to live, if you live, more than likely you'll be permanently institutionalized. Well, folks, I didn't like hearing that. I was here for hell. That man did not know the truth that he spoke. I had always been one that prayed every day of my life because I was raised by that Southern Baptist alcoholic home, you know. And that night I prayed differently than I'd ever prayed before. And I simply asked God to help me, and I've heard that other people say that that was the alcoholic prayer. But you see, when I prayed that night, there was absolutely nothing that stood between me and myself and me and God. And I remember it as if it was yesterday. When I laid my head on my pillow that night, it was like laying my head on God's chest, and he rocked me to sleep. And for the first time in my life, I knew I was going to be okay. How? I didn't know. All I knew is that God had to be in the driver's seat of my life. You know, and there on that site floor, in order to get more privileges or whatever, you went in front of your peers and you went to different levels. And it was time for me to go in front of mine the next day. And believe me, I can identify with what happened to Bill when I read his story. And my peers on that site floor, they could tell a difference. And the doctors could tell a difference. And I told them I knew that when I left that hospital, even if Jimmy and Stephanie wasn't there, I knew I was going to be okay. And I knew that God had to be in my driver's seat of my life. That was on a Tuesday. On Fridays, the families came and visited. Jimmy came to see me. And normally after he would leave, we would do group. And none of the counselors on that floor were alcoholic. And when he was getting ready, he was saying goodbye, and he was leaving, the counselor stopped him, and she said, Joycey, I've got a pass for you to go down the street to an AA meeting. I said, to what? And he said, to a meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, well, I'm going to lock down Ward. Are you going with me? And he said, no, but your husband can go with you. And he said, just go and observe and see if you can identify. Jimmy and I went down the street, and this was on Boulevard at the Fulton County Rehab and Detox Center. And if any of y'all know where that is, back in 1985, that's where you got most of your skid row. And we went into that room, and I would have told you, you know, Clancy talks about this being a disease of perception, and it really is. I would have told you early on in sobriety that that room was about three times the size. And we walked in, and the lights was down low, and they were celebrating a birthday, and it was a Mr. Ben's birthday, 7 years sobriety. And a black man from Alabama was sharing, and he told my story that night. He had been a salesman, and he talked about his constant companion that traveled with him. And then he talked about finding this fellowship, and he talked about a loving God that worked in his life. And that night when they offered the chips, you know, I guess it was the same thing that got a hold of me in that hospital room a few days before, but when they offered the chips and said, do you want this way of life, folks, I ran down that aisle, and I had tears in my eyes. I knew I wanted what y'all offered. You know, I couldn't tell you anything they read that night except the promises. And I was absolutely amazed by that. Y'all didn't say maybe, and you said they'll always materialize. And I thought, how can a bunch of people guarantee this? Because that's what I wanted, you know. Because I couldn't stand living inside my skin, you know. And booze had helped me live inside my skin for many years. You know, I went home from there, and, you know, I didn't know if I'd ever go to another AA meeting or not. And I left that hospital, and Jimmy and I started going to AA meetings and Al-Anon meetings in Douglasville. You know, and I had an opportunity to visit that group a few years later. That doctor told me, Joycey, unless you find a new way to live, more than likely you'll be permanently institutionalized. A few years later, the group was celebrating its group anniversary, and Frankie R., some of y'all knew Frankie, one of our past delegates, and he was sharing there, and I went over there, and the name of that group was the New Life Group, and that's where I picked up my white chip, and that's where I started on my journey of a new life that this fellowship has given me. a few years later, and I think somebody, maybe it was Jane, that mentioned God chooses to be anonymous with these coincidences. You know, a few years later when I was had the opportunity to be alternate state delegate, and I had worked prior to then on a bid for the International to come to Georgia. And I had sent my registration in, and I had gotten a letter from Elaine Gasta that used to be a staff worker at our General Service Office in New York. And she was on the International desk at that time. And she sent me a letter, and she called me, and she said, "Joyce, we'd like for you to chair a meeting at the International in San Diego." And the name of that meeting was the New Life Meeting. Jimmy got home, and I told him, I said, "We're supposed to be there." You know, we absolutely had no idea how our life was going to change. You know, the next 23 years has been a life that I could never have imagined. You know, and if there's any new people, I know last night we had several that were here that had been sober less than a year, and I don't know how many of you are here today. But if you are here, please don't leave before your miracle happens. Bo talked this weekend about the miracle that happened for him, and I shared with you how I felt when I was 3 months sober and that guilt and that remorse and that shame that I felt. And I was still fighting that this was not a physical disease, and that, you know, there was something that I could have done to avoid coming to the point that I came into my life. But thank God I kept suiting up and showing up, and I got a sponsor, and every time the doors of the meetings were open, I showed up. And then thank God my sponsor went on lots of 12-step calls, and she drugged me, you know. And when I was 6 months sober, one Saturday night, I was sitting at a drunk's dining room table, and she had the bottle in front of her, and she was saying, "Nothing I do is enough, Joycey. They just don't understand." And my miracle happened for me. And I saw myself in that drunk that night. And I said, "Sure, you had problems, but you and booze had become the biggest problem." And folks, I believe if that had not happened to me, I wouldn't be sober today. Or I would not have stayed sober. You know, because the next day when I went to a meeting and I said, "I am Joycey and I'm an alcoholic," I absolutely had no reservations. It tells me in my big book in the third chapter is that we've got to concede to our innermost self that we are alcoholic, for this is the first step of recovery. And that's when that miracle happened for me. And I knew what I was, and I knew who I was, and I knew I had found a way out. Thank God I had found a way out. And my life changed as a result of that, you know, has changed. You know, if somebody had told me, and I know I haven't, you know, there's all of us have our crosses to bear, and some have experienced hardships a lot more than me. But, you know, when you're going through it, it's your deal, you know, it's your deal. And if somebody had told me when I first got sober what I was going to go through the next 5 years, I'd probably turn around and walked out and said, "No way in hell." You know? And I am glad I didn't have that crystal ball. You know, my daddy had his larynx removed as a result of cancer a little less than 2 months after I got sober. And I used to go to meetings and I'd tell, and he wouldn't heal, so he couldn't start speech therapy and stuff like that. And I would have to they cut him from one ear to the other end, and I'd have to keep that air passageway clean and redress that incision. And I'd go to meetings, and I'd tell him if the phone rang and it's somebody ringing a bell, that's my daddy, and he needs help, and I'd have to go. But thank God I was sober, and I was able to do those things. You know, and he stood at my first birthday with that mechanical larynx, and he said, "I'm Jim Caldwell." And I'm an alcoholic. And he never had another drink. You know, and when I, in 88, we had been down here. And so Lisa, where is Lisa, the one that had moved away? I kept thinking, I knew you, I'd seen you before, there you are. And Jimmy and I were at that 10th one, you know. So I knew last night, that's where I had seen her before. But Daddy got sick again in 88, and he had recurrence cancer, and I was taking him back and forth to the doctor, and that cancer hadn't come back, and eventually they did find that he had another primary cancer, and when they did, there was nothing they can do, and they said, we'll try to help with the pain as much as possible. You know, and I was supposed to speak at a girl's birthday that I sponsored her first birthday the next night after the doctors told me my daddy was dying, and they didn't know if he'd had 6 weeks or if he had 6 months. And I didn't think I was going to be able to speak at that birthday. I don't know what I said that night, but I can tell you I cried all the way through that talk, and all I talked about was gratitude. My daddy passed away in March of 89, right before I celebrated my 4th birthday, you know. And it seemed like all I had been doing for months before was, you know, grieving and letting go and trying to come to an acceptance. And then 2 months after that, I sat in another hospital room, and the doctor told me my mother wouldn't live to the end of the week as a result of alcoholism and cirrhosis of the liver. And she had alcohol hepatitis. Everything in her body had shut down. And I looked at that doctor and I said, I don't feel the same way as I did with my daddy. And I said, God's going to give us a miracle. And God did give us a miracle. And later on when I would see that doctor, and he'd look up the sky and he said, I had nothing to do with it. And I said, I know, you know. And my mother celebrated 9 years sobriety in this fellowship. Sobriety lost its priority and she went back out, you know. And she's still drinking today, on and off. And I don't know how much longer she's going to live, and I pray that one of these days she's going to get sober, you know. But I have had to hit lots of bottoms in my sobriety. You know, I hit a bottom with life first in that hospital room. 6 months sober, sitting with that drunk that night, I hit a bottom with me and my alcoholism. And I've had to hit other bottoms since I've been sober, you know, with character defects and behavior and with people, and then with other people's alcoholism, you know. And I had to hit that bottom with my mother's alcoholism. And it's not been easy, folks. It's not been easy. And thank God, you know, God has enabled my life to be full and joyous as a result of being sober and as a result of having the loving God that works in my life and as a result of being a responsible member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he gave me the strength and courage to put one foot in front of the other and to do what I'm supposed to be doing, you know. And you people gave me the opportunity to serve as your state delegate. But before you did, you know, right after I sat in that hospital room with my mother, we brought her home from the hospital in July. We buried my step-grandmother I had shared with you. And then in that same month, Jimmy and I sat at that dining room table with my daughter, and he told her that he was leaving. You know, and I had gotten angry. You know, I said, you let me make it through the years of hell and then get sober, and did you mean for me to lose my marriage? You know. And I told you I had been going through grief, you know, and it wasn't just over my dad's divorce, I mean, my dad's death, but, you know, I had known for months that I couldn't go on the way I was living. And Jim talked about having to rebuild a relationship in sobriety, you know. You know, folks, Jimmy and I looked real, real good on the outside, but we were absolutely dying on the inside. In my area, I was Miss AA and he was Mr. Al-Anon, you know. And he took me to a meeting one night, and I was speaking at a hospital meeting. And that night when I shared that we had sat in an attorney's office for 4 hours the day before that day, and we had signed the custody agreement and the property settlement, you know, and that we were getting divorced. It was like dropping a bombshell, you know. And that was tough, you know. That was tough because I had no idea that I was going to get sober and lose my marriage. And so that year, all I did was grieve and let go. You know, but this fellowship and good sponsorship taught me that I make plans. You know, like I tried to make plans for this talk. I never have been able to plan a talk. You know, I just got to leave it in God's hands. You know. But I take the action and then I leave the outcome in God's hands. And thank God that's what we did. I try to live my life today by step 10 and 11 and 12. And God helped us see that perhaps we had more to build a relationship on than to end one. And so this coming December, Jimmy and I will celebrate 41 years of marriage. And I know that that would not be possible if it was not for Alcoholics Anonymous and the fellowship of Al-Anon and him having his program and him having a God of his understanding. You know, Bo talked about the vertical yesterday when he was talking about the God of his understanding in this other one. You know, and I can remember sitting on in our living room and saying, Jimmy, I love you, but I don't like you. You know, I love you, but I don't like you. And I always thought we would grow old together, and I always thought we would be like a railroad track, you know, with the two tracks going down that road, but we still had the cross ties in between, binding us together. And see, we wasn't living that way. He was going down one road, and I was going down the other road. And when we got back together, it was tough. It was tough. You know, I think about where I am today, and I know I'm going to have to wind this up soon. But I think about where I am today and all the things that I've gone through and all the pain in sobriety. But that's just life, folks. You know, that's just life. And you people have taught me to suit up and show up, and I make plans, you know, but sometimes I've got to adjust myself to meet circumstances. You know, and Jimmy and I had to learn how to share in recovery, you know, and there's not one thing I would go back and change because I like too much where I'm at today, you know, and I'm afraid if I changed one little deal in this journey, I might not be at the same place today. You know, Jimmy, he ended up alone, and I'm not going to share his story, you know, but when he ended up alone, he had hit a bottom with me and my alcoholism. But he had never hit a bottom with him and himself. Folks, this is a family disease. This is a family disease. The entire family gets sick. You know. And he had done his sponsor had moved to Savannah, and he took one of the big books of Alcoholics Anonymous that I had home, and he went down to that lake house, and he started working. And he drove to Savannah, and he did his four-step and his fifth-step with his sponsor in Savannah. And I had a girl at my house, and it was actually the girl that I had seen myself in. She was at Mar, and she was on a weekend pass, and she was at my house. And all of a sudden, that Sunday morning, he came barreling in at 6:30 in the morning, and he said, I know I don't have a right to be here, and you can call the sheriff, and he can come and pick me up. You know, because we already had the papers that said we could live as we were single, you know. And he said, but I am back. He said, I haven't been a husband to you, and I haven't been a father to Stephanie, and I haven't been a man for the last 4 years. He said, I just dropped out of the race. He said, but I am back. Folks, he had found a power greater than himself. And he was different as night and day, standing in that bedroom that morning. We didn't get right back together then, but you know, we had to work on trust issues. Jimmy was just as good as I was of saying and doing the things that he knew I wanted to hear in order to get control back and the things, you know, the situation back. And then once you got comfortable, all the whole stuff started all over again, you know. So we had to learn how to communicate and talk about those feelings, you know, and share. And I remember the state convention was in Gainesville that year for the first time in October, and we did get back together, and I told him, I said, I'm planning on going to the state convention, and you're welcome to go, you know. And he says, no, I don't think so. You go on, no. And so my daughter and I were going to go, but I noticed there was a change in him, you know, and it was like the old Jimmy, you know, he just wasn't at ease. And so finally, about a week later, and I just let him do his thing, and he came home about that it was on a Tuesday, and I remember him sitting on the sofa in the bedroom. He said, Joycey, I got to talk with you. He said, I just feel like the same thing's happened over again. You're going in one direction, I'm going in the other direction. But as he was talking, it was lifting. But you see, he was sharing how he felt with me, and that's what we used to not do. And it was lifting. And he realized it wasn't him. He had choices. I had given him a choice. And he's one that chose to stay home, you know. It wasn't me that told him he couldn't go. But it lifted. You know, but we found out that we both had the same fears and the same low self-esteem and the same insecurities, you know. And he was no different than me, except I was the lucky one. Booze made me feel okay for many years. He had nothing to make him feel okay. So our life is different. The last 19 years has been as different as night and day. And I am truly grateful for that. You know, there's so much more I could share with you about the last 23 years. And I know we've all got to go home. You know, and I look around and you know, I think about all the friends that I've made, the faces I miss, and the new friends that I've made. And I am so grateful that Jim sitting there, back there, came and let his hot water heater problems stay at home. And he came here to be with us today. But my life is so full today, y'all, as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. That little girl, 7 years old when I got sober, she'll be 31 the 21st of this month. And I've got a beautiful little 5-year-old grandson. And I had the opportunity to take Stephanie to one of the General Service conferences. She didn't attend the conference, but her and Jimmy came up to New York while I was up there. And right before she did, she had the 12-step, one of her sorority sisters. Her sorority sister had gotten out of the hospital. She had tried to commit suicide as a result of alcohol and drugs. Stephanie, we used to drag her to AA roundups, and she loved the family weekend at Effworth, you know, in June. And Jimmy and I served on that board for several years, and we had an opportunity to meet Fran and Jim that Bo talked about yesterday as being his first sponsor. We had the opportunity to be on the program that Family Weekend. They used to have couples that shared an AA Al-Anon. We were one of the couples, and Jan and Fran was the other couple. You know, and she loved weekends like that, but she never got active in Al-Anon and in Alateen. Somehow that kid just got it. And I believe the way she got it is that she was raised in a 12-step home. Program was taught in our home. And let me tell you something, she can talk it just as good as I can, and she walks it too. You know, and I was in New York, and she wasn't flying up until Tuesday night. And what she did, she drove from Atlanta to Douglasville, got in my AA stuff, found an AA meeting guide of meetings around Metro Atlanta, and she drug that sorority sister all over Atlanta to AA meetings around her schedule of classes, you know. Because she wanted her to know where the message was, you know, when she left to come and meet me in New York. And she called me in New York and she said, Mother, I took so-and-so to a 5:30 meeting over at this particular club, and I won't call the name. And she said, Mama, I was embarrassed. And I said, why? She said, if I had not known I was supposed to have been in an AA meeting, I wouldn't have known what I was sitting in. She said, you've got to do something about that. And I said, Stephanie, I can't do anything about that, you know. And she said, well, I told her to stay away from that meeting while I was gone. I said, well, good. You know. But when she was in high school, one day one of the teachers had gotten sent to Ridgeview for drinking, you know, and one of her teachers was sharing about this guy being in treatment, this other teacher being in treatment. And somebody asked him, well, what do they do at treatment? He said, well, you go and they fix you and they teach you how to drink, you know, when you come home. She hit the floor, I was told, in that classroom and said, information like that kills people every day. you know. Thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I don't know how good a parent I have been, but I can tell you this, is that I know she got lost the first 7 years of her life as a result of my illness. But I know as a result of finding a loving God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in this fellowship, I've been a hell of a lot of better parent than I would have been if I hadn't found it. And so I thank you for that opportunity. I thank you for my life. And believe me, I thank God every day for your life. And I want to close with one thing today. You know, there is no way that I could ever tell y'all how much this fellowship means to me or what you mean to me. But you've given me a life that I never could have imagined, and I do hope that the newcomer will not leave before your miracle happens. But there's a poem that I love, and maybe I can share with you through this poem of what each and every one of you in this fellowship has meant to me. I never came to you, my friend, and went away without some new enrichment of the heart, more faith and less of doubt, more courage for the days ahead, and often in great need. Coming to you, I went away comforted indeed. How can I find the shining words, the glowing phrase that tells all that your love has meant to me, all that your friendship spells? There is no word, there is no phrase on whom I so depend. All I can say to you is this: God bless you, precious friends. Thank you.